It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster. Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert are out today. Coming up, we get the story behind Guitars for Vets, a nonprofit organization based in Milwaukee that helps our veterans deal with PTSD by learning to play guitar. First, we're looking at the report released yesterday on the journalistic practices Rolling Stone used in reporting its controversial and contested article on rape at the University of Virginia, titled A Rape on Campus. The Columbia Graduate School of Journalism published the report, which said the magazine failed to follow basic, even routine journalistic practices. Rolling Stone has since retracted its story, but it says the reporter who authored the story will remain on staff. Mike Wagner is with us to discuss Columbia's report and what the reaction and what the retraction of the story means for journalism and the world at large. Mike Wagner is an assistant professor in the School of Journalism at UW-Madison. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
So let's dig into this report by the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. What conclusions did they draw about the way that Rolling Stone reported the story about campus rape?
Well, they really determined that the reporting that Rolling Stone did was fatally flawed in a number of ways that deal with traditional journalism. So it wasn't necessarily that, you know, newsrooms are declining in size and that it's harder to have fact checkers and it's harder to pay staffs and people are getting laid off, as is happening around the country. They found that basically Rolling Stone did a lousy job reporting the story. They didn't do a very good job finding second and third sources to verify key claims. They didn't push to get sources. The editors didn't push the reporter to go back out and get them, and the fact checkers didn't catch them when they had an opportunity to do so. And there was a kind of a open and shut case of a bad job of news reporting.
And this story was originally published in November. Why did it take so long for people to start really digging in behind the facts there and to find out that this was not a credible story?
Well, it didn't take long for people to start questioning Rolling Stone's story. Fairly quickly afterwards, a few prominent blogs that covered the media started to ask questions. A reporter from the Washington Post started publishing stories that suggested that everything in Rolling Stone's story didn't quite add up. And eventually, that caused Rolling Stone to kind of offer a halfway retraction of their story at that time. And then they sought out the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism to do a more thorough investigation about their reporting, and that report concluded, as I mentioned, that Rolling Stone made some pretty egregious failures from a journalistic standpoint in the reporting of their story.
So take us behind the curtain, and if we're a reporter and we hear an allegation such as this, what's the first step we take to verify the allegation?
Well, the first thing you might want to do is talk through the sequence of events with your source more than one time. And if the source isn't telling a consistent story, that's your first clue that something is wrong. But if you clear that bar and that the source seems to be telling you the same thing each and every time she or he tells you something, you want to start to locate the people that that source is referencing in the story. So in this case, the person who went by the name Jackie, or was the pseudonym Jackie in the Rolling Stone story, talked about being out with various friends the night of her alleged assault. And the reporter for Rolling Stone didn't seek those people out to confirm Jackie's story. And at one point, an editor for Rolling Stone said, well, we should probably find these friends, but then they never pursued it, and they never did that. And if they had, the Columbia report found, then they probably would have learned pretty quickly that the story wasn't one that was going to stand up credibly. And so part of the problem here was not trying to find multiple streams through which you could confirm information. One of the things we train our journalists to do is not just to take information from one source, but try to find them from multiple sources. And so, for example, if you're covering downtown State Street tonight after the Badger game, you might want to talk to local authorities about their assessments of how the crowd behaved, but you also want to talk to people in the crowd. You also want to talk to store owners. You also want to talk to people who live in the area, and they might tell different stories. And so you need to be able to try to find things from multiple sources before you are confident that what you're going to report is true.
And an interesting fact about the Columbia report is that it affirmed that the failures of Rolling Stone in this article were not due to a lack of resources.
Right.
What did you make of that conclusion? Is that a common thing about in newsrooms today, that it I mean, there are many newsrooms that are strapped for resources, but on top of that, is there a general lack of desire, I guess, to really suss out the details?
Yeah, the resource issue is a big one in journalism around the country and around the world. Newsrooms are getting smaller. It's getting harder to, you know, pay copy editors and fact checkers. Deadlines and the 24-second news cycle in some cases are so fast that it's really difficult to pay the amount of people you need to pay to do an outstanding job covering things. But that was not the problem in Rolling Stone's situation. Their problem was that when they had sources they should have followed up with, they didn't. And that's a problem of good old-fashioned reporting and not a problem of the declining size of newsrooms or the declining resources that newsrooms have.
And looking at this from the perspective of a news consumer, how can we, as we read a report such as this, discern on our own whether something is a credible story or not?
I think there are a few things that people who are, you know, just reading the news or listening to the news or watching the news can do to help judge the veracity of what it is they're being told is true. And the first thing is to be skeptical when a source is not giving, you know, her or his name. Oftentimes, sources who are asking for confidentiality or anonymity are doing so because they have an axe to grind and are hiding behind the confidential nature of not naming themselves in a story. And so one thing you want to look for when you're reading stories with confidential or anonymous sources is to see, are there other people who are confirming that information on the record? Or are there government records that also confirm this story in a way where we can trace back the information? And so anytime you can find confirmation, you should feel better about a story. It's the old kind of Woodward and Bernstein rule when they were covering the Watergate scandal with a lot of anonymous sources because of the whistleblowing aspects of their coverage. The rule was, you know, you wanted two anonymous sources to confirm something before you put it in the paper and not just one person's account, one person's claims. And so when you have more than one source, that's something that tells you as a news consumer you're standing on firmer ground with the information that you're reading.
Mm-hmm. Mike Wagner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
That was Mike Wagner. He's an assistant professor in the Schools of Journalism and Political Science at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about a report just out on the Rolling Stone article on rape on the University of Virginia campus. Pressed for time, doctors often have little time to spend getting to know their patients. An innovative program at the VA Hospital in Madison lets veterans share their stories with their doctors. Thor Ringler, the program's in-house writer, shares how the experience of talking with veterans has touched his life.
It's the first of its kind to interview patients and write up their stories. I would say 80% of the interviews we do are on inpatient units here at the hospital, and basically the process is every morning we go out and get a fresh list of patients, and then we just move through that floor from room to room asking veterans whether they'd be interested in telling their stories. So it's a pretty impromptu and sort of spur-of-the-moment decision on their part, and over half the time they say yes.
All right, so where would you like to start?
The beginning, I guess.
Yeah, huh? Sure, let's start at the beginning. Let's do that.
Thanks. Well, I was born in Tennessee in a little log cabin.
I have an MFA in poetry. That was my first master's degree and kind of my first career. I've always been a writer. I've always written my whole life as a poet. But then I ended up going back to school and getting a marriage and family therapy degree. I don't come from a military family, and I actually just kind of fell in love with vets.
The Navy talked me into it, but I wanted to sort of...
There's something about the process which is fascinating. When someone comes to you and says, well, tell me your life story, it's like on the spot, you're like, well, what's important to me? What matters to me? What really happened to me? And there's something about that that I find just fascinating as an interviewer, to watch people kind of figuring out their story in front of you.
But that's about it. And I was, when the Korean War ended, then I was there when it ended.
I started writing poems as I needed some way to process what I heard in the interviews. So some of the interviews are because of the subject matter, and I'm interviewing veterans. Some of the stories are very intensely about combat and that situation, and are very intense to hear. And as an interviewer, you're not a therapist, you know. You're not making people feel better. You're not there to help. You're there just to listen and to witness, and that's all you do. And I think that's an appropriate role as what I'm doing. But it also lets things come into you that you don't know what to do with. I actually hadn't been writing for like, because I went back to school and I was busy with that and working, and I didn't write for like 5 years or 6 years. I didn't write poetry at all. And lo and behold, I get this job and start writing up these stories, and a couple of weeks later I start writing poetry again.
How was it when you got home? Was it easy to just step back into being home?
Nothing to do when I got home. I mean, everything was gone.
And I think we've gotten emails from doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners, you know, saying these stories remind me why I went into healthcare. And I think in the end that is kind of what it's about, because really the story is like the bridge between two humans and reminding them that they're both not walking in the same shoes, but walking the same path.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. In Milwaukee, one organization tries to help veterans grapple with their post-traumatic stress disorder through music. Patrick Anettesheim is a guitar instructor who was inspired to start Guitars for Vets after meeting a Vietnam veteran. He started the organization in 2007, and it has since provided more than 20,000 free lessons to veterans in 20 states. Rob Ferret sat down with Patrick last week to hear his story of working with veterans and helping them heal through music.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us the origin story. How did Guitars for Vets get started?
Guitars for Vets was established back in 2007. I want to preface that with saying I am not a veteran myself. I'm a music instructor, a composer, and a performer. And a guitar student was referred to me back in, it would have been fall of 2006. His name is Dan Van Buskirk. And Dan served in Vietnam in 1st Marine Recon. Dan came into his first lesson and said that he had always wanted to learn how to play guitar, but felt that because of a disability, as he put it, PTSD, that would be very difficult for him to do. He had experienced a lot of what he felt was failures in his attempt to do various things that he wanted to accomplish. So our relationship started off as instructor-student, but soon the teamwork and camaraderie that can develop during guitar lessons did start forming, and he was curious as to what it was like to be a professional musician, and I wanted to learn more about his Vietnam experience. So we started sharing those stories, those war stories on both sides of the equation. Dan's definitely more intense than mine, but he would beg to differ. He's a very proud and courageous man.
Well, before we got to how you started spreading this idea, I mean, what did Dan get out of these ongoing guitar lessons? Did it help him with his PTSD, with his post-war experiences?
He believed it did, and I could see a difference as well. And I think the thing that was really the catalyst for positive change is definitely the guitar being there, but there's another element too. And I've come up with an acronym for it. I call it PAGE, being on the same page, and it's P for patience, A for acceptance, G for gratitude, E, empathy. And that's what we tell all of our volunteer instructors across the United States. You need to know how to play guitar. I mean, you don't have to be guitar player extraordinaire, but you have to have a good understanding of these components of interpersonal relationships. And it was that acceptance and that patience with him, the thankfulness of what he has sacrificed for his country, and being able to sit and listen to his stories of what he went through to get into those shoes with him, but, you know, the key is to be able to get out of it afterwards. But that really led to trust, being comfortable with sharing. So I really think the guitar is the element that allows people to emote with music and with feeling, and that segues itself to share communication verbally.
Now, as you mentioned, it started with just you and Dan. Now it's all over the country, really. How do you get veterans? How do you reach out to veterans to get involved in this program?
Well, it isn't too difficult. It seems that at some point in people's life, most folks would have liked to learn how to play guitar. It's the best way to put it, it's a sexy instrument in many senses of the word. And guitar is something that when you are playing it, it pays itself forward. The VA has, Veterans Administration, medical centers have various modalities of getting veterans involved and working with brain issues such as various cognitive disabilities, PTSD, percussive head injuries, a whole plethora of those things through initiatives like knitting, fly tying, fishing, a lot of athletic stuff, but not a lot beyond their music therapist in music. So when this is offered, you're not only going to learn guitar, but you're going to be awarded a brand new guitar after completing 10 free lessons. It pretty much sells itself just on that basis. Here's my opportunity to learn a guitar, and they're going to give me one as a badge of honor. Heck yeah, I'm in.
Hmm. Now, for the guitar instructors involved in this, is this just a normal guitar lesson for them, or do they get some kind of special training for guitars for vets?
Hmm. Well, it's pretty much what I alluded to before. It's the patient acceptance, gratitude, and empathy. We make that very clear. We have a national chapter coordinator, a good gentleman by the name of Bernie Kampf, who is also a veteran of the Vietnam era. He screens these people and speaks to them regarding the methodology of our program, which is simply teach the way that you feel the student wants to learn. Because we're doing one-on-one lessons, we can really tailor them to fit the individual, to fit their learning rate, to teach them the songs from the bands that they grew up with or really enjoy listening to. So I really like to make it clear, we are not music therapists. We are not trained therapists in any sense of the word. We're guitar teachers. But it's the act of being present with someone and not putting judgment on them and not taking notes on what they're sharing. You know, well, you're going to need this medication, you're going to need this therapy. That's for the professionals to be doing that. We are there to teach guitar, and then all of these benefits just start showing themselves, because the fact that somebody's volunteering to sit down and spend time sharing this art, and there's a tremendous amount of gratitude and appreciation that comes from the veterans that we work with, and I must say that pays itself both directions. It feels really good to help out our brothers and sisters by teaching them music.
Now, if somebody's out there listening and either they're a veteran who says, yeah, I'd like to give this a shot, or somebody who teaches guitar and says, wow, I would love to work with this program, what should they do to get involved?
Well, what they should do is go to www.guitars4, or they can use the number 4, vets.org or .com. We got them both. So go to guitarsforvets.org, and you will see a way that you can contact the national chapter coordinator, and then he will run you through the process of how you can volunteer if you want to be a teacher, or if we've got another channel that you'll be taken to if you want to do fundraising. If you're a vet who wants to get involved in the program, what I can tell Wisconsin listeners is we have 3 very strong programs in the state. We were founded in Milwaukee. At Zablocki VA is a program. Madison, the Willie Street Vet Center, I think they're still on Willie Street. They may have moved recently. And we have a great chapter in Green Bay. So, unfortunately, there is a queue, as it's called, in the system to get in. Demand is great, and the real bottleneck to expanding our mission is fundraising.
All right, Patrick, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to be here.
That was Patrick Nettesheim, who joined Rob Ferret last week to tell us his story about working with veterans through his organization, Guitars for Vets. Last week, the city of Madison became the first known municipality in the nation to give equal protection status to non-religious individuals, such as atheists. This offers the same protections to non-believers as those applied to individuals on the basis of race, age, citizenship status, and many other classifications. Annie Laurie Gaylor is with us. She's the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which supports this move toward equal protections. Annie Laurie, thanks for being with us today.
Good afternoon.
First, why do you support legal measures such as these?
Currently, the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission and ordinance had said there are about 23 protected classes, and those included religion, but it didn't include non-religion. And there are many literalists out there that would interpret that to mean that if you are an atheist or agnostic or non-believer, that you're not a protected class. And that's what Anita Weir, the outgoing alderperson here in Madison, realized, and I think it was one of her final adieu to Madison, that she thought she would make sure that this was remedied. And I'm ashamed that we at the Freedom From Religion Foundation did not think of this ourselves. So good for Anita, and good for the Madison Common Council, which there was no dissent. It passed it unanimously with 14 out of 20 sponsoring at the end, although it wasn't without controversy at the beginning.
Talk a little bit about the nature of the controversy. What had come up?
Well, it had not been approved by one of the subcommittees that needed to approve it to go on to the Equal Opportunities Commission. And two of our staff attorneys, Patrick Elliott and Andrew Seidel, testified, and that seemed to sway people, and pointed out there's a lot of discrimination against atheists. There's very practical kinds of discrimination and then more symbolic discrimination. There's about 7 states where you're not supposed to run for office if you're an atheist. Now, this is unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution says there can be no religious test for public office. But nevertheless, these states have not removed that from their books. Here in Wisconsin, we've had to fight a lot with ethnic food festivals that will allow free entry if you have evidence that you attend a church or a mass, discriminatory to those who have not. At FFRF, we've had many, many shops deny us service in terms of they won't print our literature, they won't publish things we want, bumper stickers, they won't do t-shirts. This has been for years and years. Volunteers have been told they can't be volunteers because they're atheists, for example, at soup kitchens and so on. So there is a great deal of discrimination, and in fact, studies show that atheists are at the bottom of the totem pole when it comes to social acceptance. Surveys from the 1960s on that have been analyzed about outsider groups, including African Americans and women and Arabs and Muslims, have shown that all of these groups have made progress except for one group, and that is atheists. And there are ridiculous stereotypes about us, you know, that you wouldn't want your son or daughter to marry an atheist. So when you have a distrusted class like that, that's all the more reason to have protections.
In some of the scenarios you outlined, like not printing or accepting your literature or getting, the word out about your organization through other means, as I think you used the term that it was discriminatory, some might say, well, I'm just practicing my rights under the freedom of speech, and I choose not to distribute your literature or put your organization's logo in my pamphlet or whatever the case may be. Where's the line between discrimination and freedom of speech?
Well, of course, in the last week with Indiana and the brouhaha over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act there, I think that we have seen that there is a line that needs to be drawn. The Civil Rights Act, should protect everyone. And the Civil Rights Act says, you know, race, religion, creed, color of skin, the National Civil Rights Act. But we are seeing people who are religious use their faith to violate the Civil Rights Act. And that isn't, that should not be tolerated. For example, we tried to give flowers to Jessica Alquist, who was a 16-year-old high schooler in Rhode Island who had just run a federal lawsuit against a religious banner in her school. She was a pariah. She was going to school with police protection, rape threats, death threats. She had to leave school eventually. We sent her flowers in the midst of this, and we could not find a florist in the state of Rhode Island who would deliver the flowers. We had to go to Connecticut. And the Connecticut florist that filled our order put up a very eloquent statement online at their website saying, what if you were a pharmacist and someone came in needing medicine and you told them, no, I won't give it to you because of your skin or because of your race or because you're an atheist? You could die. What if a grocer said, I'm not going to sell you groceries because I don't like your religion? That's what the Civil Rights Act is there to protect. And that's what the Madison Equal Opportunities Commission is supposed to protect.
We're talking with Annie Laurie Gaylor. She is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is based in Madison. And Madison is the first known city in the country that just passed an ordinance to protect the rights of the non-religious. How specifically will this new ordinance protect against acts of discrimination?
Well, I think it's very symbolic first. Mm-hmm. It's sending a symbolic message of inclusion. But specifically, there are fines of, I think it's $1 to $500. But probably more important, it empowers the EOC to investigate. So somebody feels that they have been discriminated against because they're not religious and they were trying to rent something or they were applying for a job or whatever it is. They would be able to now take this before the EOC and have it investigated like a bona fide act of discrimination. So it has very practical ramifications. But I think the symbolic are really more important, that this is the first time in history anywhere that we know of that atheism and non-religion has been thought of to be a protected class, that we have parity, the same rights of protection as religious people do, or gays, or blacks, or any minority. So I think society is changing, but it's changing rather slowly in terms of acceptance of non-religious. And so this is a great stride in terms of social acceptance. Made me feel really good.
And, you know, I think I read that this applies to instances of employment, housing, and public accommodations mm-hmm. in terms of the protections. And religion isn't always apparent, except maybe in instances where a holiday is observed or someone, you know, needs to take a day off or they're wearing a garment or a crucifix, something that symbolizes their faith. In what ways is atheism outwardly apparent and therefore more open to discrimination?
Well, to give an example, Chris Calvi, who is the former president of AHA, which is the Atheist Humanist Agnostics chapter on campus. It's one of the largest secular student groups in the country, very successful. He testified that most of the former presidents and board members of this successful student group do not put their hours and hours of work for AHA on their resume. They're afraid to out themselves as atheists. And, it comes up a lot. If you make an offhand remark and somebody, your supervisor, finds out that you're not religious, then what reprisal could they take? So there's a great deal of fear that you can't be yourself if you're an atheist or non-religious person because you might be discriminated against. So this ordinance would speak to that.
We're talking with Annie Laurie Gaylor. She is the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Madison became the first known city in the country to take measures to protect the non-religious from discrimination. And we invite you to weigh in on this. Do such protections need to be in place for atheists and others who don't identify with a specific religious faith? Why or why not? Have you encountered discrimination on the basis of faith or non-faith? You can let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. At a time when religious freedom is hotly debated in other parts of the country, the city of Madison became the first to protect non-religion from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. We're talking with Freedom from Religion Foundation co-president Annie Laurie Gaylor about these protections and why she believes they're necessary. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are these types of protections necessary? Do you wish you had them in your own city? Or do freedom of religion laws already by association protect non-religion? You can share your thoughts again at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Annie Laurie, many people describe Madison as 77 square miles surrounded by reality. And I wonder if this type of initiative would be successful in any other city in the country or any other, there are cities similar to Madison politically, but
I think Madison
is often deemed unique and just kind of strange. Do you think that it would be successful elsewhere?
Madison and Wisconsin kind of led the way in gay rights legislation, and that was many, many, many years ago. So it's time to recognize the growing percentage of the population that is non-religious that is encountering discrimination. You know, 1 in 5 adult Americans is identifying as non-religious. And, you know, I was telling you during the break, we had a 6-month knockout fight through attorneys back and forth with my local grocer, who was giving away free gallons of milk to customers who had proof that they had gone to a Catholic mass. And here I was standing in line.
Specifically Catholic.
Yeah. So he was discriminating not only against non-religious, but against everybody who was non-Catholic, including many faithful customers such as myself who had spent, you know, thousands of dollars loyal to a local grocer. And that was a lot of, you know, that's a major benefit, a gallon of milk a week free. Mm-hmm. And he just didn't get it until finally, you know, with the attorneys, he finally realized, you know, I said, you couldn't do this to white people and then make black people pay more. It's exactly the same kind of discrimination. And so I think that it's very important that this should be adopted around the country. And I do anticipate it's just happened, so we're just getting the word out. But we know there's a lot of secular groups around the country that are very excited about having something positive to organize around.
Let's take a call from Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm well. What's your question?
Well, my question is, doesn't this infringe on the religious rights of those religions, you know, like you just mentioned, the Catholics and the grocer? If the grocer didn't say you have to prove that you're a member of that congregation, I mean, everyone is invited to any Christian church anywhere at any time. And you don't have to be a Christian, let alone a member of that particular sect of Christianity. So if there's somebody that's going to be LGBT or atheist or anything coming in there and say, well, we were discriminated against, it's like, no. All you have to do is go to church and get your proof that you were there, pick up a mass thing there, pick up a weekly program from whatever other church it is, bring it into the grocer and pretend
to be something that you aren't. No, I don't. That isn't lawful. That is a violation of the Federal Civil Rights Act as well as the new ordinance here in Madison. You can't do that. I mean, this is fundamental. 1964, this was passed, and look at why we passed it. The segregation in our country. I mean, this is a very important principle that has to be grasped. You cannot discriminate.
Thanks for that call, Bob. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Margie joins us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a atheist, and I'm a member of a very well-known 12-step group. And any time that I say something about not believing in God, there's always someone in the group that's going to have to preach at me. And I just really resent that. Usually I just keep my mouth shut, and when they're done, I just say, well, you know, the best thing about being an atheist is I don't have to proselytize. And, but yes, everywhere you go, it's you can't say, I don't believe in God, because people take it as a, like you're saying, they are wrong. And even with my kids and a couple of people in the program, I don't care, whatever works. If you need a higher power, fine, go for it. But I don't need one, and I've been sober for 22 years in this program, and I don't need a higher power to get there. And so, but if somebody else needs one, that's fine with me. I'm not saying you're wrong.
Thanks, Margie, for your comment. Annie Laurie, what's your response to that?
Well, I think that she's right that so many non-believers, freethinkers, are afraid to come out of the closet because our very presence is seen as some sort of an insult to believers. And we tend to be very, for the most part, respectful, silence ourselves. But people who go to church or religious people don't feel that way at all. It's quite the opposite. As she's pointing out, there's a lot of proselytizing, a lot of preaching. That, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And here in Madison, when religion is a protected class, it is absolutely proper that irreligion or non-religion should also be a protected class.
And but when you're face-to-face with somebody who really doesn't agree with your standpoint on something as deeply held as religion and God, how do you recommend that people respond? How do you constructively articulate your point of view?
Well, it really depends on the circumstances. I mean, it might be something as light as when someone says, bless you after you sneeze, and saying that's a funny thing to say to an atheist, but thank you. You know, there are different ways to go about it. It depends on the circumstance. But certainly, we should have free speech. We should have civil rights, the same rights as every other U.S. citizen. There's a tendency to tie piety to patriotism, and that's very unfortunate, a result of the 1950s entanglements like In God We Trust and putting under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. But you do not have to have a religion to be an American or a good American, and I think that a lot of people have forgotten that.
In our last minute, is your organization, Freedom From Religion Foundation, planning to take this idea to other cities or states?
Yes, we are going to be working with our chapters. We have about 19 of them, and we're also spreading the word with the growing multitude of secular and free-thinking groups, regional, statewide around the country. There really is a great flowering of free thought right now. So we will be promoting, we will be proselytizing this particular ordinance.
Annie Laurie Gaylor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Annie Laurie Gaylor is co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. A team of UW-Platteville students is teaching an unusual gardening class to prison inmates. Their goal is to help inmates confront the harm they cause their victims and learn a skill that they can use to give back to their community. In the first of a two-part series on restorative justice, Gilman Halstead sat in on a weekly class at the Prairie du Chien prison.
Serving time in prison is supposed to be punishment, but it's also a chance for offenders to learn to empathize with their victims and find ways to make up for the damage they've done. Robin Klein of the UW-Platteville Transitional Help Center tries to explain that to a dozen inmates gathered in a circle in a prison classroom.
I called this project off the bat Growing Community. The whole purpose is for you to get these metaphors, right? The idea that it's so primal to need to care for things, to see things through, to overcome adversity, to reap those rewards, and then to start all over again.
Klein created this class a few years ago with the help of the Ridge and Valley Restorative Justice Program and recruited UW-Platteville students studying criminology to teach it. Inmates interviewed for this story asked that only their first names be used. Jess is serving time for burglary. He says the garden metaphor works for him.
I've been locked up my whole life, you know. So doing programs like this, like planting a seed, you know, you got to nurture a plant, and almost like a kid, you know. It's kind of weird thinking of it that way, but I think it's going to show me how to become an adult.
The class begins with inmates sitting in a circle, talking about how their crime hurt their victims and their community.
My victims and my crime would feel distrust and be unable to trust anybody, really.
our primary victims were killed. So I believe their family and my community feels hurt and victimized and kind of shell-shocked.
It's more than one victim because it's like a ripple effect that everyone gets involved, you know, and you're, you know, at some point everyone's getting hurt, and it's not just the victim, it's everyone.
That was David, Ramaya, and Paul. After everyone's had a chance to talk, it's time for some hands-on gardening.
That little seed right here.
I don't think so.
A flower. Something grew from that little bitty seed.
I know, isn't that crazy? Think about a pumpkin. See how little pumpkin.
Tonight, one table is covered with dried lupin and larkspur plants. The inmates are stripping the seeds off so they can plant them.
So when this thing is... This is dead, but it ain't dead.
Yeah.
The live part is the seed still that served the purpose.
The flower part, yeah.
After the hands-on work is done, the inmates gather again in a circle to talk about how to connect what they've learned to life after they're released. John is serving time for his sixth drunk driving conviction.
To me, it's a sense of self-satisfaction. And to watch that plant grow, think about yourself growing as an individual and branching out to the community, giving help.
The programming supervisor for the Prairie du Chien prison, Lisa Patera, says this is different from the vocational horticulture classes offered in other prisons that focus on training inmates to work in a greenhouse or a gardening supply store.
It's not intended to turn these guys into master gardeners. It's intended to be a foot in the door to their community.
And for most ex-convicts, that's just as important as finding a job and a place to live. Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Gil, for that report. Tune in again tomorrow for part two of this series.